You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. Coming up, we learn what strep throat looks like this year amid a shortage of one form of an antibiotic often given to children with the infection. Now, people around Wisconsin and neighboring states will head out to their local wetlands this Saturday, hoping to hear this sound. That's the call of the whooping crane, one of the birds that volunteers will be watching for during this year's annual Midwest Crane Count. The International Crane Foundation has held the count on a large scale since the 1980s, now covers more than 150 counties in seven states. Sarah Gavney Moore is the Digital Communications Program Manager for the International Crane Foundation, which is based in Baraboo. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us and letting us share our story with you this afternoon.
Yeah, what is the goal of our Midwest Crane Count?
Well, it's kind of twofold. One, the main goal since it started in 1976 is it's a really powerful tool for creating awareness about cranes and their wetland habitats. But what also it does help us do is really help us study the population trends and the new areas where cranes are colonizing. When it was first started in the mid-70s, cranes were just coming back to Wisconsin, so it really allowed us to watch them as the population grew and dispersed. And now we're doing that in states like Ohio, where cranes have been recolonizing the last few years.
There are a lot of volunteers around the Midwest who take part each year. How do things on a practical level work? What do they do?
Well, to get involved, if we have someone who's a new counter, you can go to the International Crane Foundation's website at cranecount.org, and that will put you right on the Crane Count landing page. The first step is to look to see if you have a county coordinator. And we have county coordinators distributed throughout the seven states that are involved in the count. And they help with locally publicizing the count, as well as helping counters choose a survey site, making sure they have their data sheet, helping answer questions. If you go to our website and you find that there isn't a county coordinator for your area, you can contact the International Crane Foundation and we can help you get involved. And you can do that by emailing us at cranecount@savingcranes.org.
We've got a caller. Christian is with us in Madison. Christian, hello. Christian, are you there?
Hi, I'm from Madison, and I hear cranes all the time, and I think the crane calls are pretty, like, the calls of the cranes are pretty majestic and beautiful, and they just put me in a certain place that makes me wonder, how did just some biomatter turn into these beautiful, majestic things?
Christian, you know? Thanks for the call. Can I ask how old you are?
I am 11.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Christian. Now, an 11-year-old a few decades ago, Sarah, wouldn't necessarily hear that sound so much here in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about why we have so many more sandhills now in particular that Christian's able to hear?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for that call and your enthusiasm. I think we have a future craniac. Well, sandhill cranes almost disappeared from Wisconsin in the first quarter of the century. There were concerns that maybe there were only a couple dozen breeding pairs here. And the reason for that is there was unregulated hunting and also our wetlands. If you're hearing cranes, you're probably near a wetland area or an area where they can find food and where they can find a safe place to nest and find safety from predators. But what happened is that there were laws enacted that protected the cranes from hunting, and then also laws that help us protect our wetlands. And then also I think just people like our caller who are excited about cranes. I think more and more people are opening their eyes to the cranes that are in their neighborhoods and seeing what they represent. There is almost a spiritual component to them, isn't there?
Thanks for that call, Christian. And Christian also wondered some about, you know, the life cycle, the biology of cranes. How much of a crane's development happens, say, in wetlands here in Wisconsin?
Sure, yeah. So the cranes are beginning to pair right now, and the male and female pair will mate and lay one to two eggs, and those chicks will hatch out after about a month. And then the family, they'll raise them for about 3 months near the nest. And then at about 3 months of age, the chick will begin developing its flight feathers and begin flying. And that's all in preparation for migrating south in the fall.
Now, we've been talking about sandhill cranes. Now, let's talk about the whooping crane effort. This has been a long-term project, still going on. How are the whooping cranes doing in Wisconsin now, Sarah?
Yeah, they're doing well. There are kind of varies on year to year, but the most recent years, there have been between 70 and 75 whooping cranes in the state. And that's a huge difference. With sandhill cranes, we estimate there are probably around 50,000 that are found here in Wisconsin. But those 70-ish whooping cranes are coming up. They're breeding, they're pairing, they're breeding, they're raising chicks. And we actually have a really cool feature on our website. It's whoopermap.savingcranes.org. You can go on that map and you can see where the different cranes are by county. And we do keep the whooping cranes location. They're not secret, but we keep them at the county level to make sure those birds have safe places to nest and to raise their families.
And as we wrap up, Sarah, you mentioned people can go online and register. You're still looking for last-minute people to sign up for Saturday's Crane Count?
We are, yeah. There's still time to get involved. Just go to cranecount.org, look for your county coordinator, and if not, email us at cranecount@savingcranes.org.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Sarah Gavney Moore, Digital Communications Program Manager at the International Crane Foundation, which is based in Baraboo. She talked with us ahead of this Saturday's annual Midwest Crane Count. We've got a link to more info at WPR.org/Central Time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a comedian's search for humor in tragedy.
A house fire is a tragic thing to live through, and comedian J.C. Catlin would agree. He's done it. But in his new short film, he also proves that tragedy plus time equals comedy.
My name is J.C. Catlin. I wrote and am the star of everything I learned when my house burned down, and I am a comedian.
It only takes a few hours for your house to burn down. But after that, you continue to live inside its burnt-out husk for months and years. When my house in rural Wisconsin burned down, it was the coldest day of the year.
JC had fired up the seldom-used wood stove in the basement to help keep his family warm.
And then all of a sudden I thought, you know, that's smelling kind of strong. And so I got up and all of a sudden heard my kids screaming. And by the time I got into the living room, there was already like flames shooting up through the floor.
He managed to put the fire out briefly with one of his fire extinguishers, but as he went to grab another, the fire reignited and quickly grew.
So I just kind of like called 911 and ran away, you know, thinking the propane tank is going to explode or something. Like you want to get away from the house because it was already just totally engulfed in flames.
Everyone made it out safely and managed to stay warm, even the hamster.
When you're grabbing the cup, walking out with the hamster cage, putting it in the back of the car, you know it's bad.
A couple days later, he went back and posted a video to YouTube of the aftermath.
It somehow has turned into a cave. Typically, houses, when they burn down, don't turn into a cave. But in this case, my house decided that it would. So I thought that while it's still cold, and the caveness is preserved, that we really have to document this because it is important to remember in these times of loss that something new and beautiful always is left in the ashes. And in this case, it's stalactites and stalagmites, my two favorite kind of stalag things.
So the water from the firefighters' hoses was freezing to the ceiling from the cold, melting from the fire, and then refreezing on tables, counters, and floors.
Which was, you know, kind of oddly beautiful, but also, you know, when it's your own house, it's just kind of like, it's pretty heavy imagery.
Considering how tragic the fire was, the YouTube video was actually kind of funny in places. JC says he wasn't really going for humor, but it got him thinking. And that's where his friend Joe comes in.
My name is Joe Pickett. I'm the director of Everything I Learned When My House Burned Down, and also the curator of the Found Footage Festival.
Jokes are how JC and Joe both make a living. So finding some humor in the fire came naturally to them.
Takes the edge off, you know, and sometimes it's necessary to get through these things any way you can.
I think laughing at tragedy is a uniquely Wisconsin thing. And for this film, we're really trying to strike the balance between like, yeah, this is a tragic thing and we shouldn't just be laughing at it. But then it's also like, this is how we deal with it.
So they filmed JC inside the burned house like he was still living there.
That's the conceit of the short, is that we wanted JC to go about his normal day-to-day routine in the burnt-out house. So yeah, he's vacuuming, he's listening to extremely warped records that don't play on a record player anymore.
Hi, is this the library? Yeah, what's your policy on, like, if the books are, you know, a little bit, like, on fire?
JC says in the film that things get better, but sometimes it's hard to notice. 2 years later, he's still dealing with it.
Going through and, you know, remembering, oh, we don't have a grapefruit spoon. We got to buy a grapefruit spoon. That's every single day. You know, there's just something that you don't have that you used to have, and then you assume it's somewhere because you used to have one. Oh, no, it burned in the fire. You know, so that still goes on all the time.
For more on Everything I Learned When My House Burned Down, a comedy, you can visit our website at wisconsinlife.org. Thanks, guys.
Sweet.
Great.
Thanks.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, strep throat is back. An infectious disease expert explains what to look out for and when to go and get tested for it. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, strep throat has crept back up along with other infections with the end of most pandemic precautions. Strep is more common in kids. Adults can get it too, though. And strep A, a more dangerous potentially form of the infection, is higher this year in both kids and adults. Megan Meller is an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What are we looking at when it comes to numbers that we know of strep throat infections these days?
Yeah, so what we're seeing here locally, at least throughout the Gunderson system, is we call it a positivity rate. So the number of people getting tested and the number of those who are getting positive. And we're seeing that rate sitting between 40 and 50%. So quite a number of people who are getting tested for it are in fact testing positive.
Now, a lot of respiratory illnesses kind of waned, it seemed like, during COVID. People were wearing masks, not associating as much. How does this compare to COVID era, and how does that compare to pre-COVID?
So strep throat, or the, you know, the bacteria that causes it, it's really behaving very similarly to what we were seeing with these respiratory viruses during the pandemic. And so, you know, prior to the pandemic, strep throat was just something that kids, you know, school-age kids just learned to deal with. But during the pandemic, cases really dropped off, you know, along with what we were seeing with like flu and RSV. And then similarly, now that we're coming out of the pandemic, you know, schools are reopened, restrictions have ended, we're seeing this surge in cases, much like we were seeing with RSV earlier this year.
Now, I'm learning as this goes on, there are different kinds of strep. What kinds are we seeing most commonly, and how do they differ from one another in terms of how severe they are?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple different types of bacteria out there, but the one that causes strep throat is what we call group A strep. And this is where, you know, it can cause concern because, you know, for most cases of strep throat, overwhelmingly, you know, kids recover really fast. But what's alarming is that sometimes those infections can become invasive. And so what that means is the whole body gets infected and people get really sick. You know, prior to this, you know, we've seen adults come down with group A strep invasively for other reasons. But what we're starting to see now is those numbers in both kids and adults increase.
What is the most common treatment for strep throat?
Antibiotics. And so, you know, it's very common antibiotics, amoxicillin, even penicillin, can treat those strep throat infections. And, you know, for the most part, it's pretty effective. Resistance or bacterial resistance is pretty rare, but it can happen. And, you know, we have seen that sporadically here. And so it's always a good educational for the community to say, if you're not getting better with your current antibiotics, to talk to your healthcare provider again, because you might need to have your treatment changed up.
Talking to Megan Meller, infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System, looking at the return of strep throat into common circulation. If you have a question, you can call in quick at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Megan, my kids are a little older now. But when they were younger, I think my most common health question as a parent was, when do I take my kids in to get tested for strep? How do you answer that question?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is a question a lot of parents ask because, you know, a sore throat's a sore throat. So it's like, is it a virus? Is it bacteria? A really good distinction with strep throat is you won't have the upper respiratory condition. So you won't have the coughing, the sneezing, the nasal congestion. You're just going to have that sore throat, usually some swollen tonsils and a fever. So that's really a good hallmark that if they're having those symptoms in the absence of upper, you know, the congestion, to make sure that they get in and get those antibiotics.
Do doctors tend to prescribe those antibiotics without getting that strep test first? Because a lot of the things that cause those other symptoms are viruses. Antibiotics don't do anything to them.
Right. You know, and some may, but there's a really common, easy test that can be done in most clinics that can happen, you know, where parents can have the results of that test before they even leave the clinic. And so it's really helpful for providers to know that right away, this is what we're dealing with. And it kind of looks at it. It's very slick.
I want to talk about the complications of untreated strep. Now, when I was a kid, I had strep throat all the time. One time we were looking through our files and it turned into scarlet fever for me, which I didn't know was a thing still. What are some of the things that can happen if we have strep and don't treat it?
Yeah, and this is when it can get really serious. Like I said, it's still overwhelmingly rare, but sometimes it can potentially lead to death, you know, without treatment. And so that's where if someone's not showing any indication that they're improving, they might maybe say they had strep throat, but now they're developing a full-blown rash in their body. You know, the fever is really high. It's really important that they are seen in like the ER urgent care, because that's when you might need some more intensive antibiotics to really cure that infection.
Now, if we know someone in a family has strep, how quickly does it spread from one person to another? Can we take steps to avoid catching it from one another, say in a household?
Yeah, because, you know, when we talk about like who's at risk, you know, we know kids are very commonly can get it, but also adults who interact with kids are also fairly susceptible. And we're seeing kind of that with grandparents too. And that's because strep A can spread by respiratory droplets or even like direct contact. So if you're sharing, you know, drinking out of the same cup, or just even if a, you know, child, you know, wipe their hands on a surface and then you touch that surface with a hand and then touch your face, that's a really easy way to get exposed. And so prevention is then also pretty easy. It's not sharing utensils if someone is sick. It's washing your hands, not touching your face with dirty hands, and just regularly disinfecting the household.
Now, I know flu, there's a flu season, influenza, fall, well, half the year, it seems like some years, but is strep seasonal like that, or does it come and go a little more predictably?
Yeah, you know, there is some seasonality to it. So commonly the seasons last from December to April. So it's still pretty long. So hopefully we start to see a decrease in numbers shortly. This past year, so in late 22, we did start seeing an uptick in September. So it did kind of start a little earlier, but that's, again, not surprising given how strange some of these other viruses have been behaving out of their season. So hopefully we'll start to see that resume or kind of come back to normal next year.
Now, as you mentioned, kids vulnerable to this, something to take seriously. And anybody, are there people we're particularly worried about when it comes to stress with strep, when it comes to things like compromised immune systems?
Thankfully, not really. So, you know, in some of these cases too, you know, even kids who are getting, you know, or, you know, getting these invasive infections, to my knowledge, you know, there's no other underlying health condition. Sometimes, you know, these infections just kind of behave on their own accord. And so that's why, you know, if your child is in a little bit more immune compromised, it's always important to take those extra precautions just to make sure they're not getting unnecessarily exposed. But for the common person, you know, just taking those additional steps of just, you know, if you're not feeling well, stay home, you know, stay home. Be mindful of who you're sharing utensils with when you're not feeling well, and washing your hands.
Now, within a clinical setting, are there extra steps you need to take during strep season to make sure things don't spread within a clinic? It's from what you described as transmission, it sounds like the sort of things I assume you're doing anyway.
Exactly. You know, and I think from an, you know, infection prevention standpoint, these are things that we always relayer with staff as, you know, making sure that you're washing your hands before you go into an appointment, before you leave an appointment. And then our standard room disinfection practices apply. So it's something that we're not concerned about spreading within our clinics because it's it's such an easy bacteria to kill with standard disinfectants.
Now, I'm allergic to something most of the year, so I have a constant game called allergy or current illness. What are some of the things that would distinguish, you know, that seasonal allergy that, say, 70-degree weather in April in Wisconsin might bring about versus a strep symptom?
Oh, I totally get that. You know, and I think because I have the same thing, it's like, is this a cold or is this allergies? And I think one of the things we just need to remember with strep throat is that you're not going to have those respiratory symptoms. And so I think the bigger question is it a cold or is it allergies versus strep throat? You know, another hallmark too of strep throat is if you have your child open up their mouth and look at their tonsils, if they have any white streaking on their tonsils, if we've all had it before, you know, you're like, you know what to see. That's also a good indication that you might have strep throat or at least some sort of bacterial infection and need to be seen.
We've been talking about strep, but are there any other illnesses on the horizon that you as an infection preventionist in Wisconsin have on your radar right now?
You know, not at the moment. Thankfully, you know, we're always kind of watching current rates of, you know, Lyme, you know, tick season is not far around the corner here, especially here in Wisconsin with the warmer weather. So, you know, we're always watching those numbers and always just kind of staying alert because, you know, in this day and age, you never know what's right around the corner.
Megan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
That's Megan Meller, infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System. She talked to us about strep throat. She mentioned ticks. I already have a friend who already had a tick out in nature this season. So keep an eye out when you're out hiking. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the modern United States is built around cars and roads and parking lots, and a guest makes the case that that's often not a good thing. Meet the author of the new book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Plus, we'll look at the role of siblings in our lives and what having them or not having them can mean for childhood development. Join those conversations and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then you can learn how to learn and use those lessons to do better at school and on the job. Find out more from the psychologist who wrote the book Study Like a Champ. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Think back to the last time you had a big test or exam to study for, whether it was years ago in high school or college or just last semester. How'd you get ready? Flashcards, practice tests, rereading your notes from class, maybe a little bit of everything. Our next guest says if we want to know what really works, we can look to psychology and how our brains actually retain information. He's looking mainly at school, but there are lessons here for learning at all levels, for work, fun, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you study during your time in school? Did you take thorough notes? What did that look like? Did you pull the infamous all-nighter to get ready for the big exam? What worked for you? What didn't seem to work? If you're a student right now, how do you study? Do you study? Teachers out there, how do you encourage your students to study and prepare? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology and director of the general psychology program at Oregon State University. He's director there of the Center for Teaching and Learning, and he's co-author, along with John Dunlowski, of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. He's a former UW Green Bay professor. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back, Rob.
Well, one thing that I learned from your book is I might have assumed that, you know, I'm either good at studying or I'm bad at studying and there's not much I can do about it. The good news of your book, I think, is we can get better at it.
And that is, I think, a great place to start because far too often, I think people have mindsets that go, I can do this, I can't do that. And I think most of us have probably heard now, whether it's math or something complex, instead of saying, I can't do that or I'm not good at it, a good way to go is saying, I'm not good at it yet. And I think that's exactly what we set out to do in this book is to say, look, even if you haven't had success before, here are some really clear-cut things you can do that can make you better at it. And it just takes some practice.
You start with some myth busting and public myth number one, I think, the idea of learning styles. So we each have our own learning style and we need to be taught and learn in a particular way. And this, a lot of people, I've thought this in my life. A lot of people that are listening right now, I'm sure, believe this, Regan. What does the research show?
So here's the big deal. I think I want to make clear the distinction between preferences and matching a teacher and student's learning styles. We all have preferences. We all have preferences for how we like to do things and learn things. But what the research looked at is it really important for the way a teacher teaches to match the preferred learning style of a student? And a very large study looked at all the research that was available and came to the conclusion that matching teaching style and learning style is not important. And in fact, we tend to learn better if we are exposed to different styles. So if you are somebody who goes, insert learning style here. Let's say I am a visual learner, but this person uses a non-visual style, therefore I can't learn. Well, nope, the research shows that's just not the case. So don't use that anymore. That learning style myth has been busted for some time now, but like you said, it's got some staying power. It's still out there. And every year I see the memes out there about learning styles. And I think we've got to remember, move on. You don't have to match learning styles.
That said, there are some things we need to understand about ourselves. And here's one that really hit me. You talk about the idea of a feeling of knowledge. Like, and maybe at some point in everybody's school career, they had the thing like, hey, I got this. I'm ready to nail it. And then you don't nail it. You didn't know as much as you think you do. This is really important. How do we evaluate our feeling of knowledge of the upcoming test, say, versus where we really are?
Right. I think one big thing for us all to remember is that we are very good at deceiving ourselves. We are very good at deceiving ourselves, especially to make us feel better. And our cognitive processes aren't always a direct reflection of reality. So when we talk about the feeling of knowing or the feeling of knowledge, very often it really comes to play when we ask ourselves, do I know this or do I need to do more work on it? And very often we may be overly confident and think we know something when that's not really the case. And let me give you a really specific, I want to share something really specific where that really helps out here. Mm-hmm. This happens very often when we have what we are trying to study or what we want to know in front of us. So imagine studying with a textbook or, if you are somebody using flashcards, remember imagine having a whole bunch of flashcards in front of you. I don't know if you watched somebody use flashcards, Rob, recently, but if you take a look at somebody using flashcards, they will do the classic flip of the card, right? They look at the term on front of the card and then say, oh, do I know this? And then do a quick flip of the card to look at the answer and go, oh yeah, I know it. Well, that's exactly one of those very practical things you can avoid doing to make sure that your feeling of knowledge or feeling of knowing isn't skewed. Because if you have what you're trying to study in front of you, that artificially inflates your feeling of knowing. You think you know it more than you really do because you're not factoring in the fact that there it is, you can see it. And whether that's a flashcard that you've just flipped or your textbook sitting there, inflates the feeling of knowledge. You spend less time when you really should be spending more.
Talking to Regan Gurung about his new book. He's co-author, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If there's something that's worked for you studying at in high school or college or learning to pass a professional exam, something on the job, something that worked for you, something that didn't work for you. If you're doing it right now, maybe you need some advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Regan, you looked at research that's out there that compared a lot of different things that can be, many of which can be helpful. What stood out to you as the number one or two things that really pay off for study styles and methods?
Yeah, let's, jumping straight to the punchline, as it were, if you have time, your time studying is best spent testing yourself on the material. That's the number one finding across cognitive science, is that repeat testing or repeat practice, you testing yourself is one of the best ways that you can prepare yourself to learn. And this is in contrast to spending time rereading the material, even studying highlighted material or even flashcards. I mean, flashcards are useful. Studying key terms are useful, but not by themselves. The number one thing you can do is test yourself. The second best thing you can do, and I'll give you the top two, right? Because these are the two that are head and shoulders over everything else. Repeatedly testing yourself and spacing out your studying. And I think in the intro, you mentioned cramming. What cramming does is the complete opposite of spacing, right? Cramming is cramming it all into the night before the exam. The flip side, spacing it out, that's what's really good for you. And I love the way my co-author John likes to talk about it. He says, if repeatedly testing yourself and spacing it out were to date, they would lead to the really best way to do it, which is test yourself repeatedly, but spread out over time. And that's what's really going to get stuff from your working memory into your long-term memory, and you're going to be able to hang on to it much longer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Cottage Grove. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share my experience of going back to college in my 40s. I never have a college degree. I dropped out of college when I was in my 20s, and I always regretted it. And I always thought, I can do that. I could do that. And I never went back. I finally went back for a healthcare degree, which is a pretty demanding field, and I really had to learn how to study. And I just wanted to share how I did it. I actually graduated 4.0 top of my class, and I got a 97 on my boards. Yeah. And this is how I studied. So as an adult, you care more, right? Because you pay for your schooling out of your own pocket. So I wanted to study as much as I could, but I wanted it to be efficient. So I would tape all of my lectures on my phone and take notes in class, and then I would get home and I would rewrite my notes in outline form, and then I would listen to the lecture the next day on my way to school. And then in the end of the week on a Saturday, I would rewrite my notes again, but this time I would photocopy diagrams and color them in and label them. And then when I went to study, all my notes were perfection. So if I had to study, I had it all written two or three times already. And I kind of knew it all already, but I also made flashcards on my phone.
Wow.
Which now you can do in digital. So when I was sitting in waiting rooms, I would do flashcards. I was always quizzing myself. I would have people look at my flashcards and quiz me.
Nice.
I just did everything I could.
Rebecca, congratulations on going back, getting that degree, doing so well. I hear so much from your book there, Regan, spacing it out. She did that, you know, yep, over the course of time with the same material. Go where you want with it, because she gave us a lot to work with.
Oh, and you know, I mean, Rebecca, that's almost a case study in some of the best things to do. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of different things in there. The biggest thing I hope everybody listening saw or heard is Rebecca did a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. It's not just flashcards. It's not just one thing or the other. The real bottom line with studying is the more you do with the material, the better you're going to learn it. The deeper you process it, the better you're going to remember it. And I have to underline one big thing in what you said, Rebecca, because it's a whole chapter in the book, and that's note-taking. Note-taking is one of the most underutilized study techniques. It is an actual study technique. It's not just capturing information. And your example of writing and rewriting and playing with your notes, that's just such a neat thing to keep in mind, because when we take notes, we are processing the material more, and you doing that multiple times helped you process it more. And wow, yeah, no wonder there was a 97 there. So good job.
Rebecca, thanks again for calling. We're talking to Regan Gruing, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story in your own life of effective studying or less effective studying, something that you thought might work but didn't, or you were pretty sure wasn't going to work and were proven right along the way. Or if you're a teacher, if you teach people stuff, love to hear what you see in your students. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Regan Gurung, psychology professor at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. You can join in with your study habits, how they worked or let you down. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hello, everybody. I taught writing in English for MPS for years. In fact, I founded the creative writing department at the High School of the Arts. I stayed in touch with many of my kids at the beginning, and the main reason they were able to succeed in college was that they were able to write. I spoke to the superintendent that making reading the top priority is wrong, because reading is passive, writing is active. We work with journals, we wrote every day. In fact, when the head of the English department did a,
I think I got you, Bill, got some background noise there. But Regan, the value, I mean, especially with the subject like English, the value of writing and journaling and just constantly doing it.
Yeah, and I think that nicely underlines the note-taking point, because when you're writing, right, you're really having your brain do stuff with the material. And, you know, definitely in creative writing courses and in English courses, but I think writing in any format is getting you to do things with the material. That's why, you know, whether it's writing an essay or writing notes in class, instead of just writing down what's on a slide, you know, push yourself to write about what you're hearing, write about what you're reading. And even if you don't have a writing assignment in the class, you writing and pulling thoughts together and material together is having you do stuff with that material that, again, helps you hang on to it more and brings out more, you know. And that's why I think I have to throw in this, you know, in higher ed right now, there's all this, you know, a lot of us are concerned about ChatGPT and AI and writing. And it's almost like as good as ChatGPT is, the soul in the machine isn't there. And when we write, you know, there's stuff that's the emergent properties of our different thought processes are coming together in a way that where AI isn't there yet, you know, which is why any writing in class, any writing to process the material is going to help you learn better.
Bill, thanks a lot for calling in. Diane joins us now in Elkhorn. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a daughter that was dyslexic. She was a very oral learner, and when she needed to learn something, I would sing it. I would put it in a song, and she could learn it. I would sing her spelling words. I would sing her history facts, and now she works with a girl that has autism, and when she needs her to get dressed, she puts it in a song, and she has time to put on deodorant, and the girl sings, no stinky bits, no stinky bits. Anything I needed a child to do, if they wouldn't do it any other way, I would sing it, and oftentimes they would do it.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Whether it's singing or something else, Regan, I think creatively engaging with our material seems to be something that is going to help us.
Right, and beyond creatively engaging, what you see here is you're using more than one modality. So there's a more general term we call this dual coding. Whenever we're trying to remember something, if you can dual code it, where it's not just a word, but it's a word and music, or it's a word and a picture. To remember complex things, and in some cases, even things, you know, routines that you want to remember, if you can link something with either music or an imagery, it makes remembering certain things easier. And I think that's what we had here, was that it was almost a mnemonic device where that repetition yoked or tied to the melody helped, you know, recollection of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. back to your calls now. Maddie is on the line in Milwaukee. Maddie, hello.
Afternoon. How are you guys? Great topic.
Thanks. So what experience do you want to share with us, Maddie?
Well, back to Rebecca, and I'm assuming it was nursing school. I also went back to school after having other degrees in my 40s. And at MATC in Milwaukee, I found an amazing instructor. Unfortunately, she's passed away. But she taught a learning strategies course that really opened up my eyes and made me realize what my strong suits were and how to really hold on to what I was trying to learn. And in nursing school, there's a lot of heavy material.
I bet.
And this learning strategies between auditory, tactile, which writing your notes, auditory by recording the lectures and re-listening to them, and then verbally saying things out loud as well. So I love what Regan is teaching, and I think the professors and the teachers out there have seen students struggle, and they're finding ways to give a lending hand any possible way they can, because our future is about education and people having passion in their work. And when you're struggling with test anxiety and so forth, that's when you start having people drop out of school.
Maddie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Regan, the idea of a class in how to learn, I'm assuming you are on board with this idea.
Oh, absolutely. I actually teach a course in the science of teaching and learning where we go into it. And, you know, honestly, it's not even just the class. I think far too often, many of us, especially in college and universities, assume that our students know how to do this. And it's not that easy. There is science that shows you the right ways, but it's not necessarily what you would normally think of as being the right ways. And I think, I'm a big proponent of it, no matter what class you're teaching, especially if it's a first year class or a second year class, take time out of class to talk about study strategies, to talk about the best way to go. Because both Maddie and Rebecca alluded to, you know, many medical terms and a lot of terms to memorize. That can be stressful, but the good news is a lot of these strategies, retrieval practice and note-taking and spacing, those are exceedingly good, especially if you have medical terms or a lot of content to memorize. So right on board with that, we need to be talking about this more and not assuming that people know how to do it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Maddie. Regan, I want to talk about big picture strategy. In one of your chapters, you talk about scheduling, having our plan of how and when we're going to fit these different study methods into our actual lives. Can you tell us, give us an overview of that?
Sure. I think one of the thinking about thinking and planning all falls into the jargony term metacognition. But metacognition, or really planning out your studying, is really the first critical step to establishing a good study pattern. And I think this becomes even more important when you factor in that a person may have 2, 3, 4, 5 classes and work and all of these different things to do. So when you plan out or schedule out when you're going to study, that makes it more likely that it gets done, because then you can visually note what all you have to get done and where. It's also important to actually walk the walk of some of these key practices. I mean, I may say repeatedly testing yourself is good, and I will say spacing it out is good, but it's very hard to remember to space things out and remember to repeatedly test yourself when you've got 5 classes and work. So starting with scheduling, and you find the way you want to do it. I'm old school. I love paper. You can use, you know, an app, but have a schedule of when you're going to do what, and that right there takes out some cognitive load, mental load, and it makes it easier to focus on what you have to do and when.
Regan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the book Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. If you have a lesson learned you'd like to share, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.